Okay, with Justin Gray, who is a musician and also a director, Immersed, a cinematic immersive album by Justin Gray. It's an hour cinematic album, which is something that we used to see back in the day. We don't see as much anymore, but it's really great to see. Just first question, what motivated you to make a cinematic album of your music?
That's a great question. I mean, musically speaking, this is music that I've been working on for a while, specifically to be an immersive experience. And by that, I mean, I sort of composed the music to be played back for audiences in a 360-degree kind of fashion. And the best possible way to do that is to present music in a movie theater. You know, movie theaters, first of all, I love cinema, but movie theaters are incredible playback scenarios for people to get to listen to music. I know we're used to going to see the movies, but the soundtracks themselves have been produced in multi-channel formats, whether it's surround or in this case Dolby Atmos, for decades at this point. So I thought about the music from the very beginning as being paired with the film so that I could create this sort of film experience, but be it an album listening experience. So that's sort of where that started.
So Immersed is the title, and you basically have an opening of in your in the film about you explaining what Immersed is. And it's a cinematic immersive album, so you seem to like the word immersed, but explain to people what that means, that word means to you.
Absolutely. I mean, of course, when we say immersive audio or we say immersive cinema, this is referring to technology, but immersed itself is a feeling, right? It's a sensation. And as the film opening sort of alludes to, probably the most visceral version of that that we all know as human beings is to be in water, right? Is to be completely surrounded by something. It's such a unique sensation. But in all reality, I think that we are immersed in our environment at all times, whether that be the physical world around us or our feelings. Sound is everywhere, vibration is everywhere, light is everywhere. So it is alluding, I guess, to the kind of overall artistic feeling that I'm trying to get at with this particular music and with the film, is that I'd like people to experience and be able to completely sink into the experience. And that's happening sonically at a technical level. Visually, of course, this is this, you know, a more classic approach to film. It's not using 3D film or anything along those lines. But yeah, I think it's just a philosophy behind the intent of the art.
So you have your music, and then you want to make a movie of it. But of course, there's got to be a story, and you use the word immersed as kind of your thematic or your kind of like starting point of the story. Then you have the visuals. Tell me about, did you write a script that on top of your music? Like, tell me about the experience before you started shooting works for the film.
Absolutely. So of course, when there's no dialogue and it's an album listening experience, the story itself becomes abstract. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there's not a through story. So I love the question. The characters in this story or in this album are the musicians themselves, right? So the acting, if we can see it that way, is the musicians actually recording the music in the studio. Now, we've all seen videos where musicians are recording, and we've all seen movies of, let's say, live concerts. There's so many of great live concerts. In this case, the challenge that I gave to my co-director, Michael Fisher, who's the cinematographer, the director of photography, was I wanted to shoot and record this project not with every musician in the room at the same time. Now, this is for a couple reasons, largely because of the sound. So, sonically speaking, I did a lot of specific ways to record the music so that when you listen to it, it's naturally feeling like you're very surrounded by it, but also surreal. At times there's, you know, sounds that are moving around us in ways that can't happen in nature. So I really needed to record things very, very specifically. As a result, Michael had the challenge of shooting the thing in small groups and sometimes individuals, which is way more like how we make a movie. So the sort of storyline that we made was I identified for him in the music who needs to be looked at what time.
Okay.
And the way that we went about doing it was we just shot every single performance of every single studio musician over the course
Okay.
of 35 days. That's like 4 to 5 camera angles per person, usually about three operators, so three of our best angles, and then sort of two safety angles or angles on sliders, like just to get a little motion. In general, we ended up using largely, of course, the camera operator angles just because they're more human and they were our best angles. And so I think a lot of times what we had to do was we had to capture an immense amount of footage, and then the story is put together afterwards through editing. So Michael might be sitting on 70, 80 angles to choose from at any given moment. And we go through and use the music to say, who do we want to see on screen? And of course, our goal was not to show every single person and every single song like a YouTube video, but rather to have this arc over the course of the film.
And you wrote all the music.
I did. I co-wrote the music with two friends for two who are musicians on the project for two of the songs. But yeah, I'm the one who's created all of the music, and I co-produced the music with the violinist on the project. His name's Drew Jureka.
And then, so like all the instruments in the film, it's like that was all in your kind of vision in creating the
Absolutely.
music.
Absolutely.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
When did you start? How old were you when you like knew that you love music? Because I'm assuming you love music. So,
Of course.
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a professional musician of multiple decades.
Yeah.
I'm also a professional mixing and mastering engineer of multiple decades. So,
Michael, you're still in your 30s, multiple decades? Okay.
yeah, I mean, in the sense I'm almost 40. Almost
Okay.
40. So, I started, my music career starts right after college, so right in my very early 20s. And I started playing bass very seriously when I was about 12, and I like honestly from the age of 12 I shut down everything else in my life and went really, really obsessively into it. But as I sort of described, is like there's a lot of different avenues of the music industry that I've been able to be a part of, and it's been fun that way. So at first it starts out with bass. I just want to be a bassist. Once I got past that, I was always fond of writing music, even in my very first band with my good friends. There's like a garage rock band, but we would learn great tunes and then we'd write and we'd write. And I think even when I was in college, I was always writing, writing, writing. Then, I sort of go through, like I said, many, many years of touring and playing with artists, whether here in Toronto or around the world as a bass player. And then the studio side of me is also there and has actually sort of taken priority for the last 10 years of not touring and playing as much. I've got my family. I love being in the studio. That part of the career sort of took off. But in terms of just the conception of the music, this music has been brewing for about, I'd say, 5 years. I wrote it over the course of a year. It's one of those things where once you set a deadline for yourself, you start speeding up towards the end. So, but I'd been thinking about wanting to make this experience, the idea of a cinematic album experience for quite a while. But it takes a long time to put all the pieces together.
So you started you so you just got into music when you were 12 years old. That was the age.
So I started, playing clarinet in when I was 8, in
Okay.
school,
Did you
like
play
in
the
band
piano? Did you
class.
learn the piano as a kid or no?
Nope, piano came after bass. So I was just playing clarinet in the band. I liked it, but like whatever. I wasn't passionate about the clarinet. And then it legitimately started grade 7. It was a battle of the bands that you could enter. My friends had started a Rage Against the Machine cover band. And I got to play bass. I was like, I'll join. They're like, all right, bass is what's left. So, but from the moment that I picked up a bass, had a first band rehearsal, started taking lessons, and I had a great, great, great teacher at a private studio here in Toronto called Scarborough Music, which is unfortunately no longer there. And my first bass teacher at 12, like within a year, it was like, this is everything. It just sort of took over, and I realized how much I loved it.
That's amazing. And so, and how would you, because bass people know, like I'm talking about the average audience member, they know bass is in a band, in a regular band. There's the guitar, there's the drums, sometimes there's a keyboard. But how would you describe, what does the bass do in a regular, in an average song? Like what's the
Right. I mean, you might notice it most when you hear a bass line. You might think about a great Michael Jackson tune or a great Motown tune or, a great pop or hip hop tune where the bass line is prominent. But outside of it being like a melodic thing, which it can do, it's always providing, it's a part of the groove. It's a part of like with just right there with the kick and the snare from the drums of driving the music forward, but with pitch. So it has a melody to it, and therefore it's the thing that ties the drums and the harmony all together. And realistically, if you take the melody of any song, that melody needs a bass part to make sense because it gives it a sense of how it works harmonically, which I mean in the chords. So sometimes it can be very subtle, but it's the kind of thing that if you remove that low end and you remove that pulse of the bass in most music, you would know it as soon as it's
Yeah.
gone. But sometimes it's at its best when you don't fully notice that it's there either. So yeah, it's a glue between the harmony, the melody, and the groove.
So you started playing in bands. So you did the Rage Against the Machine, and then you started doing private lessons, and then you started doing, so you were in a bunch of, like, I'm assuming, like, teenage garage bands and with your
Yeah,
friends.
absolutely. Well, yes, but very, very quickly I moved into being obsessed with jazz music. And
Okay.
so eventually I went to Humber College, where actually I'm on faculty as a teacher now. That's it here in Toronto. But I was a student at Humber College, went through that jazz program. It's a contemporary music program, but jazz is like the home base for
Okay.
it. I play double bass as well. I don't play any upright bass on this record, but I play it just as much as electric bass. And so really by the time I graduate college, just early 20s, I'm like deeply obsessed with jazz music. But I also started traveling to India, and I spent a lot of time in India studying Indian classical music. And that was inspired by, my mom is Indian, but we listened to some Indian music, but realistically that was actually inspired by some musicians here in Toronto who had moved here from India who were amazing teachers. And I just started studying the music and became infatuated with it. So right after finishing college, then I actually lived in Calcutta for a little while studying with a singer there. And then eventually came back here and started to mix it all together. And at that point, what it means to be a professional bassist, you can either be the front person of a band, you can be in a whole bunch of bands, which is more my story of like being a freelance musician. So you might play in 40, 50 more projects over the course of a year. You go on tour with this band for 2 weeks, play this band on the weekend, record with this band for their next record, and you're just sort of moving around the community.
Wow. And that's what you do now still?
No, so that was like, yeah,
In your
my all
twenties?
my
Okay.
20s was that. I love it, honestly. I still have lots of colleagues like that. It's a absolutely beautiful, beautiful thing. I mean, what an incredible opportunity to get to be surrounded by inspiring people, constantly playing every night. But for me, the studio side as a engineer, specifically in the world of mixing and mastering, so post-production and film, that's always been there for me. And that really, I started finding myself really wanting to just dedicate the time and the effort to that area. So a lot of the bands I was playing with, suddenly I was producing with them, or I was mixing for them, and eventually mastering their records. And so for the so the 30s and even a little bit late 20s, like that was the period where I transitioned. And then of course, when the pandemic hit, live music just
Yeah.
was a no-go. And I found myself at that time really being able to be involved in the community as a pure engineer. And when it sort of came back, I was like, you know what, this is where I'm at. At the same time, here I am making another project because I just couldn't keep out of it. So I think maybe by creating the space of just being on the engineering side, I also think it created the sort of creative mental space to be able to really put this thing together.
Yeah, 100. Well, you're a producer, right? So
Exactly.
you know how to get a job done, like to kind of see a project through to the end, which you did with
Yeah.
this film as well. But you're also very creative as well. So you have that kind of, you can, the old cliche, both sides of the brain kind of concept, right? So
Right. Yeah, totally.
and then see, people could go, we'll link your website on your on the website, so you can see, like, what you're into, and you've won Juno Award winner, and you've got obviously different things. And I think that what people, like, I was just having a conversation with somebody who was like a family thing of all places about, like, how they were obsessed with music, but they're like since retired, they still do a, they're still in a band at like 65 for the last 40 years of their life, but they never kind of took the plunge to be a music, like a professional musician, because they're always scared of the unknown, right? So, and
Yeah, I
you're
mean,
yeah, go
no, I mean, it's
ahead.
like anything. There's so many aspects that need to come together to be
Yeah.
able to see it through. And the end of the day, any level of being involved in music is a beautiful thing.
But well, 100%. But what did, was that something you thought about in your 20s? I'm just curious about, like, or is this something that you were just obsessed with and you just had to do it?
I didn't have a choice. I mean, I remember, I mean, that's at least how I felt. I think I remember when I was in my teens telling my parents, like, look, this is it. Like, there's, and they knew. Like, I'm like, there's no, I can't conceive of not being, of doing this. And, you know, their advice always was like, just in that case, commit yourself, do the best you possibly can at all times. And of course, that combined with good, you know, the fortune of being in a wonderful city like Toronto, surrounded by such high level musicianship and opportunity has led to this. And then, you know, this project, there's 38 artists in total. These are people I've worked with, I've produced with, I've played with. They're very close. It's like a family kind of energy, even though it's a lot of people. I know everybody on a very personal level. So to be able to bring them all together to then realize this, we've got musicians from virtually every part of the world, you know, representing musical styles across a wide range of genres. It's definitely not jazz, but it's got elements of rock and classical music and Indian music and Iranian music and Cuban, Afro-Cuban music. I mean, all these various influences kind of come together. And of course, I can think of them all as a composer and a producer, but at the end of the day, just like any film, it's only as good as the actors, or in this case, as the artists. And so bringing this team of people together and getting to, you know, have them combine their energies, their creativity, their skill sets, and that's what really makes it special.
So you have acts in your kind of I would call calling them acts, like you kind of have title cards for each kind of sequence, right? And first of all, I have to ask, what's the type of bass that you're playing? I've never seen that before.
I played two basses in the project. The first one and the main
In
one
the beginning,
is a six string bass, and it's an electric bass, six string bass, and the six string bass has been around in fusion and jazz music for a while. So the middle four strings are like a normal four string bass, and then the upper and lower strings extend the range. So it's built by a Canadian luthier. It's a dear friend of mine named Les Godfrey, and it's an instrument I've had for a long time, that was custom built for me. So it's absolutely beautiful. The walnut and the ebony and the scroll, you know, craftsmanship is there, and it's a dream to play. And then the other bass I play on two songs. One is Repose, the third piece, and Pendulum, the seventh piece. It's called the Bass Vina. Now, the Bass Vina is a hybrid fretless bass, which means none of the metal frets that you see on a guitar or a bass. And it's an instrument that I designed and invented for Indian music. So I was studying Indian music, as I said, and I was there and I was playing my regular electric bass, and it wasn't quite fitting within the rest of the instruments I was playing with over there. So I called Les up. It's the fun thing about knowing a great luthier, which is an instrument builder, stringed instrument builder. And I sent him some drawings, and then of course he took it and realized it. And so the Bass Vina is a very at that, and that's the only one. It's the only one in the world.
So, but you don't want to, did you like copyright it? Did you kind of like,
I mean, it's an interesting thing. So at the end of the day, we looked into those kinds of things, but what you realize is when you study the history of instrument building, some of it is, it's all a lineage. So at the end of the day, the Bass Vina, I mean, it's such a specific thing to me that there have been even been other people who have reached out to Les who've want to played it. And his answer to them is, if this is the instrument you want, let's build you one. And of course, they could do it. But for the most part, he's like, you need to understand how personal that instrument is to Justin. So to me, because I everything to the scale length, to how the strings work, how they're tuned, it was based on how I wanted to play music. And so what usually happens is they're like, oh yeah, actually, well, I want to play music this way, and he'll build them another custom instrument. So, you know, in the world of patenting and this, I mean, sure, if millions of people wanted one, that would be valuable, but it's such a personalized thing that we haven't really seen that be a necessity.
Well, maybe the
Who
marketing
knows?
will dictate that people would leads the people want it.
Exactly. Let's see. Let's see.
Remember the beginning of the guitar, right? So like that.
Right?
So it was okay. So the second part is the I'm just being general, so I apologize, but it's the Indian dancer, right?
Yes.
So she like so that tell you said you 38 people were part of the project. We'll get to the other dancer, the next piece, but so you're in terms of dancing, how did you kind of how did you film that? How did you kind of like choreograph that? How was that all processed together?
Yeah, great question. So, yeah, as we'll get into, there's three dancers on the project, but on the third song, Repose, which is actually where I'm playing bass, Veena. Bhagyashree Vaze is the dancer. I've known Bhagyashree for a while. She's a Hindu, or sorry, a she's a Kathak dancer, so an Indian dancer, and she knows the music. She's also a great Indian classical singer. We've played a lot of music together. So I had finished the. The whole film was done from the studio, and Michael Fisher, the co-director, and I sat back. We watched it and we realized, okay, we need to go somewhere else. We can't just be in this one setting. So we sort of storyboarded at that point. And I was like, again, I think about people because at the end of the day, I need the performance to be like the right performance. So I thought about Bhagyashree and I thought about the other two dancers as well, which we could talk about afterwards. But Bhagyashree knows this music, she knows the what I'm playing intimately. And so I called her up. We set the setting as the Aga Khan Museum in here in Toronto. It's a beautiful hall that I know the artistic director. I was able
Where
to
is
get in
that
there for.
museum? I'm just curious. I've never been
So
there
the
before.
yeah, it's an absolutely fantastic place. So you go up to, it's like basically DVP in Eglinton. It's a little bit north of Eglinton, just west of the DVP. You actually see it when you're going up the Don Valley Parkway. You'll see on the left, just north of Eglinton, this gorgeous marble building. And that's the Aga Khan Museum.
Sorry. Go ahead. Go. So that's where you shot it.
So it's in their auditorium. I've played 100 times in that concert
And then
hall.
she
Like, and I've
choreographed it. She choreographed
no,
the.
so it is an improvisation.
Oh, gotcha.
Now, it's an improvisation though, based on a bunch of criteria. So she had the music in advance. We talked about the energy of trying to spin, you know, being like a general. We were there together and sort of crafted, you know, so let's start low, let's start slow, then let's start to move a bit more in this way. She also, again, she knew the musical performance, so her hand gestures are representing the kind of range that the performance is in, like low notes to high notes. The night before, we had actually done the mehndi or the henna, which is on her hands. We actually did that the night before so that it would be, you know, all fresh. Color palette wise, you know, she gave us a couple costumes that we could choose from. And then there's three cameras. Actually, at that point, I'm one of the camera operators myself, Michael, and another camera operator. One, I had the one on a crane, and then Michael and Eric Bernhardt, they had the other two. And you know, we sort of lit it. We played the piece back a whole bunch of times, and she did a bunch of takes. And then the actual performance itself is cut into the music between two takes. So I'm editing because it does cut off. You know, I go look at a musician, then I see her. The ultimate piece that she's doing is sort of cutting between two performances.
And then the indigenous performer, nice, great
Yeah, so
costume, great setting. It's like they're kind of in a wind in the winter, kind of dancing in
absolutely.
the
So this
forest.
is Cody Harper. Cody is an Indigenous dancer,
It looks like it
and
was
her
snowing that
family.
day, which is great.
Amazing. Yeah. So I've known Cody. We've collaborated on stage many times. And so Cody has a deep, deep history with her family and going back. And I asked her, you know, this is the piece called The River's Edge. I sent her a couple pieces and said, do any of these speak to you? She chose that one because it's in like a three beat pattern she was very fond of. And so I asked, I was like, okay, well, we got a couple options. We can go inside or outside. She said, outside. It was winter. We both know this last winter was cold and snowy. And she recommended Rockwood Conservation Area, which is just outside of Guelph. She said she grew up near there. She knew it quite well. So we went there. We picked a day. How lucky are we that right when we get there, it just starts this pillowy, beautiful snow. It was cold. It was like -8 this winter. It was pretty chilly, but you know, so Cody came already prepared. We drove in, her family dropped her off. We had Michael and myself and the other camera operator were already there. We'd sort of scoped a spot, but realistically, we got there. I played the music back over a Bluetooth speaker. And again, we took like three takes, but actually her performance there that's used is only one because it was snowing so much that by the third take she's covered in snow and the editing didn't work. And again, we had talked in advance about she wanted to do what's called fancy shawl dance, so that's her own choreography, but it's an improvisational reality. I mean, it's not specific to every moment, but rather let's have an improvisation listening to the piece of music that she's already aware of and has rehearsed to, and then let's just capture that performance, which to me is, it's very much like how the music is, right? Like I get the musicians prepared, and at the end of the day, they perform that day, we film that day, and that's the music. And so I find dance and music can, especially dancers who are very adept at improvising, we think the same. So it's the same kind of approach, and therefore I think that's how it sort of links into the music nicely. And then of course we also took a bunch of shots of the conservation area. Like we have some insert shots of the river in slow motion and the various other places.
And then you're in the next sequence, you're in a garden. You shot some of the, where did you shoot the garden scenes? I'm calling them
Yes,
garden scenes, but
exactly.
they're.
Yeah. So that is at the Cambridge Butterfly San Conservatory.
Okay.
So the song is called Illuminate. And, you know, I was thinking abstractly, to be honest, like the concept of dance, I would have been into it, but I was like, well, the three dancers, like, I don't know, those are the folks I know. Like I could, did something else didn't come to mind. And one of Michael's daughters, the co-director, said butterflies. And both of us went like, ooh, butterflies. They, you know, they have, they sort of represent, I don't know, a certain just natural beauty. But the thing with Illuminate being the song, I was like, Michael, I want it to be very bright. I want there to be light. And in the dead of winter, a butterfly sanctuary is like, you know, because of the glass, it's super well lit. We, of course, brought lights in. The crazy thing about that day is we got there in the winter, and it took over an hour for the fog of the cameras to die down so that we could film. It was the humidity, like, even though he kept the cameras warm in the car and everything, like, the amount of time it took for the humidity and the cameras to dissipate was over an hour because inside that place is just like a sauna. So we sort of went around, figured out, and again, at the end of the day, but this was a cool thing though, is we went there thinking that the butterflies would be the main character, let's say. But then there was this beautiful waterfall. And water is a theme, you know, flow, the pendulum art that's painted, you know, we maybe talk about the pendulum art as well, but the concept of flow, the concept of water, it's, you know, it's this beautiful improvisational act that is the flow of water. And I love it. And so as soon as we saw that the waterfall, we could get underneath it because there was a pathway underneath it. And then we set up the cameras and started to film it in slow motion. And ultimately, the water and the light became the character, and the butterflies almost became like extras to a certain degree, which was, you know, you never know sometimes till you get somewhere, and then you just have to have your creative brain ready to go.
I like how you started the film, kind of like do the intro, and I loved your credits too, like showing
Thank you.
the behind the scenes stuff and like kind of setting up lights and then having a conversation. I thought it was great. It's like it's you're dare I say you've immersed us. I was about to say that and I realized that it was a pun, but you immersed us into this entire film from your thematic and your kind of concept, kind of discussing it and then kind of showing like how we got it done. Like not everything, but showing us like instead of just having not boring credits, but having credits, you show us something else. It's really cool. I thought that it's a really
Thank
great
you.
idea that you guys did. So
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. So at one point,
yeah.
about a year and a half ago, I sat down with Michael and I thought, I love documentaries and I do think that there's a story to tell and how this thing's made. It's complicated. There's a lot of people involved. And, you know, sometimes art is contextualized by explaining it to people, right?
Yeah.
We can actually learn to appreciate things when we understand a little bit more about how they're made. So at one point, I cut together a bunch of stuff and showed it to Michael, and we did an experiment of actually having in between the songs, having little documentary stuff, which would ultimately have made it like a documentary.
Yeah.
And it had its charm. I will admit it had its charm. However, it broke the overall spell that was just listening to the record as it was intended.
Yeah.
And ultimately, we decided to stick to what it was that we wanted to make.
Yeah.
But I always wanted to show it. And so credits, you know, where I took, like, where I've seen that kind of thing in credits is usually it's like funny B-roll, right?
Outtakes.
It's outtakes.
Yeah.
And I was like, but it, I mean, here's the thing. As a movie watcher, I am always the last one in the movie theater. I love the credits. I like reading the names. The composers oftentimes get to be very experimental and very outrageous during credits. So, if, for instance, if you watch like an epic Zimmer movie, and I'm sorry, like Hans Zimmer being the composer,
Yeah,
the
gotcha.
credits, the credits is oftentimes where they get to be the
They get
most
to do,
adventurous,
yeah.
and it's the only time that they get to usually present a piece of music from start to finish in a film.
Yeah.
Right? So you get 7, 8
It's
minutes.
true. Yeah. Yeah.
John Williams, like if you go see the Star Wars films from like not the originals, but like the
2000?
credits roll,
Yeah.
yeah, the
Yeah.
credits roll, you get full epilogue, like
Yeah.
full pieces of music that didn't happen in the film. So I'm always sitting there being like, this is amazing. My kids are like, we got to go. I'm like, no. You could do whatever you want. I'm sitting right here. The lights are coming on. They're already sweeping the popcorn. And I'm like, guys, you're missing out. Like, this is beautiful. So I wanted to
But now the
use the
streaming
credits.
services, now Netflix, they don't even do the credits. They just
They
like,
don't even do the credits.
yeah.
And I whatever, it's not whatever. Who cares what the Netflix is not going to change their mind, but I disagree. I think that crediting is important. Now, the credits was also, I realized there's a lot of people and it took 7 minutes to roll it out. Well, 7 minutes is a perfect mini documentary length. So we sort of kept together like behind the scenes outtakes in a way that by the end of the credits, you're like, oh, I sort of understand how that was done. And I think I'm glad that you enjoyed it. And I found that other people have enjoyed it as well.
Well, it seems like this is a great. I love this. And I wish you the ultimate best of success with it. I know that I was on the website. It was saying that it's going to go in different avenues in August. I don't know what the plan is yet, but yeah, I hope it does whatever you expect from it. I know this is kind of like a difficult kind of distribution deal one would assume with your film and kind of the abstractness of it and the length. But I hope it serves you well. I hope it gets you what you want.
I appreciate that a lot. Yeah, I mean, August 22nd is the release of the
Okay.
album. The way that people can experience the full film and the music as intended outside of movie theaters is on Blu-ray. And so there's a physical Blu-ray that,
Oh,
and
wow.
with Blu-ray, you can experience Dolby Atmos, which is the immersive sound production technology, in full resolution, and you can obviously have beautiful, beautiful quality cinema picture. So obviously, the world of physical media is not growing, but there is still a very dedicated audiophile community who loves, including myself, who love to listen to music in high resolution. And Blu-ray offers that. And like you said, I'm still working on ways of presenting it in more movie theaters. I've done a bunch of screenings so far with Dolby in Los Angeles, San Francisco, in Toronto. It's been a wonderful experience. People have really enjoyed it. So I'll just continue working on the distribution side of things and get it out to as many folks as I can.
That's amazing. Well, I just scratched the surface with you, and because I could have talked to you about forever. This is amazing stuff, and you're on. Like, it's great. I know this is not easy to do. Like, so many moving parts, so many artists, so many shots, so much footage. It's like this is a huge project, and it's done. And with that, you should, hopefully you're proud. You're proud
I
for
am.
just doing what you
No,
did. It's amazing.
I am, and
It's
I
there
appreciate
forever.
that.
It's there
Yeah,
forever.
and I think it's very important to take those moments for ourselves as creators and say, you know what, I'm proud of this, and I'm proud of everybody involved. I've enjoyed the journey, but I'm also enjoying the destination, whatever that may be, the ever-moving
Sure,
destination.
yeah.
And I'm so excited that, you know, the viewers of your festival chose it to be their festival choice. Like, I
Yeah.
think it's amazing. It's not about, we don't make these things for that, but as artists, as creators, it's those moments where someone acknowledges it, and it's very helpful, right? It helps to energize us. It helps us to recognize that these things we create
Yeah.
in our for ourselves almost are being appreciated by others. So I appreciate what you do and what the festival did, and that it got to be chosen to be the best of the festival. I think it's amazing.
Well, I wish you the ultimate best of success. Let's talk again when you make another film or when we run into each other again. So I appreciate
I
it.
look forward to it. All right,
Yes.
thank you.